Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Anna Mock, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and partner with the professional services firm of Deloitte & Touche. I'd like to welcome our radio audience and also remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's guest speaker, Frank Wu, Dean of Wayne State University Law School and Vice Chair of the Committee of 100. The Committee of 100 is a national, nonpartisan, nonprofit membership organization that brings a Chinese American perspective to issues concerning Asian Americans and Sino-U.S. relations. Today's program will focus on the results of a new survey on Chinese and American attitudes towards one another, commissioned by the Committee of 100. Let me tell you a little bit more about Dean Wu. He is the author of Yellow, Race in America Beyond Black and White, and also co-author of Race, Rights, and Reparation, Law and the Japanese American Internment. In 2004, he returned to his hometown of Detroit to serve as the ninth dean of Wayne State University Law School. From 1995 to 2004, he served on the law faculty of Howard University. He also has taught at Columbia University, the University of Michigan, and Stanford University. His articles have appeared in numerous publications, such as the Washington Post, LA Times, Chicago Tribune, and USA Today. His media appearances are numerous, including the Oprah Winfrey Show, Now with Bill Moyers, the Lehrer NewsHour, O'Reilly Factor, and Talk Back Live on CNN. He has also hosted episodes of Asian American, a PBS syndicated television show. Prior to his academic career, Professor Wu worked at the law firm of Morrison & Foerster. He is also the 2008 recipient of the Chang Lin Tian Education Leadership Award, recognizing his significant academic and leadership accomplishments. Please welcome Frank Wu.
Good evening. What an honor to be here at the Commonwealth Club, one of the most distinguished public forums in the United States for the discussion of policy issues. It's my pleasure and privilege to speak to you about the Committee of 100 survey entitled Hope and Fear, the title capturing the dual themes of our findings. As Sir Francis Bacon once said, hope makes a good breakfast, but a poor supper. And as we walk through a summary of the 75-page report, which is available here at this presentation, as well as on the Committee of 100 website, I hope that this snapshot of one of the most important bilateral relationships in the world today offers us an opportunity for greater understanding, not just of China, but of the United States as well. Before I begin, I'd like to ensure that I thank the co-chair of the survey process, my colleague Cheng Li, who is a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution, as well as Yong Lu of the Committee of 100 staff. Without their fine work, this wonderful survey could not have been done. I'd also like to take a moment to tell you a little bit about the methodology, and this is summarized for you in the report itself so that you have confidence in what we're about to present. This survey is unprecedented, although there have been numerous efforts, many of them admirable and that we have relied upon, to study public attitudes here in the United States toward China, as well as to study Chinese attitudes toward the United States. Never before have people attempted to study both American attitudes and Chinese attitudes toward the other country at the same time by asking the same set of questions. And that's what we set out to do, to determine exactly what Americans think about China and what Chinese think about America. Conducting this survey last year over a period of many weeks during the height of the product safety concerns, so that this will offer for many years to come a baseline from which we can measure the trends and see the patterns as they emerge. What we did is we retained the top survey firms in both countries. Here in the United States, we retained the very familiar firm of Zogby International, one that you know for its polling work on numerous subjects. And in China, we retained Horizon Research, a firm that has adopted Western survey techniques that has as its principal someone who's a scholar trained at Yale. They conducted face-to-face interviews in Chinese cities, in major towns, and even in villages to ensure a margin of error that's even better than what we were able to achieve on the U.S. side. So we can have confidence, then, that what we're about to present offers an accurate view of the public attitudes. And I invite your questions during the Q&A session, because vigorous dialogue is what lies at the heart of our diverse democracy and helps enlighten us as we study the multifaceted issues presented by this relationship. Let me begin by summarizing why we chose the title Hope and Fear. We chose that because we found, ironically, that the very same factors that cause great optimism on both sides of the Pacific, both in the United States and in China, also lead to apprehension and anxiety, principally economics and the trade relationship and partnership. Although majorities in both nations believe that trade is beneficial, they also see it as a likely source of conflict. This theme is repeated again and again and again. In every aspect of the relationship that we examined, we saw both simultaneously this wonderful hope, this sense of optimism, this buoyancy, and yet alongside it, in measurable ways, we could see that there was also the possibility of negative backlash, often arising from the very same factors. We examined such subjects as product safety, Taiwan, environmental and climate change, the emergence of China as a global superpower and the potential military threat that China poses, the Beijing Olympics, and we took a look at the difference between the opinion of elite leaders and the general public. So let me begin with the overall impression. The overall impression, what we asked on both sides is, how would you describe your impression of China here in the U.S., and how would you describe your impressions of the U.S. in China? And we found favorable impressions, although on the U.S. side, because we had conducted an earlier survey just 2 years ago, we were able to see a downward trend by about 7 percentage points, the proportion of Americans who view China favorably. That may be attributable to the product safety scandals involving pet food and lead paint and toys and so on and so forth that dominated the headlines at the very time that this survey was being taken. Although as you peruse the findings and the many tables, we invite your interpretations as well. Our goal is just to offer as much data as possible, and as we examine it, there likely are very complex causes, both historical and current causes, for all of the patterns that we see. We found that the American public tends to associate China with its large size and massive population and with its unique culture. And in contrast, on the Chinese side, the respondents most commonly focused on the ongoing war on terrorism, on foreign policy, and on landmark buildings and cities, on the prominent tourist sites with which they're familiar. We found that there was a difference in the views of elites and the general public. This was remarkable and striking. What we did is, on the U.S. side, we took special surveys involving subsets of business leaders, opinion leaders, and the senior members of congressional staffs working on Capitol Hill to represent the inside the beltway perspective. And what we found is a mirror image. On the U.S. side, elites tend to believe that the general public holds a negative view of China, But that's not actually true. While on the Chinese side, opinion leaders overestimate the positive view that the general public is likely to hold about the U.S. So on both sides, we see these contradictory and paradoxical attitudes. Among Americans asked to rank the most important nations and partners, China ranked just behind England and Japan, so it's the third most important trading partner, while for the Chinese, the United States was clearly first, followed by Russia. We asked in particular about the benefits of bilateral trade as this trade relationship, ever dynamic, becomes more important for both nations, for the United States as the dominant superpower in the world today, and for China as clearly an emerging power. And we found, interestingly, across racial groups, across political groups, across all demographics, including among union members, that the perspective in the United States is that bilateral trade with China is good overall for the U.S. economy. 72% of the American public either strongly agrees or somewhat agrees with that statement. The margins are higher for business leaders, as you might expect. Yet, at the same time, despite this hope, we see the fear. For when asked to name the leading causes of concern in this relationship between the U.S. and China, the top four were, in order, trade, China's domestic stability, energy concerns, and security in the Asia-Pacific region. And then when asked, those are the areas of greatest common interest. When asked about the greatest concerns, they were loss of U.S. jobs to China, the U.S. trade deficit, China's human rights situation, and China's environmental degradation. And a solid majority of Americans believe that trade with China leads to the loss of U.S. jobs. So despite thinking that trade with China is beneficial for the economy as a whole, there's also the feeling that trade with China has its detrimental consequences for Americans, especially in the loss of jobs. And the feeling is that they're linked, that they go hand in hand, that trade with China is a cause of the loss of jobs. So while the United States does accept China's emergence, and that's another one of our findings, that Americans believe that China is becoming a superpower, and that China is likely to become more democratic, although most Americans believe the process will take 20 years or more. And business leaders predict that China will become the world's largest consumer society, with its more than 1 billion potential purchasers for all sorts of sundries and goods. When we asked about which nation will be the leading superpower in the world 20 years from now, so we're asking people not just to tell us about the present day that we inhabit, but also what they forecast, what they foresee for us and for our children. We found that in the United States, that 49% of Americans believe that the United States will remain the world's leading superpower 20 years from now, but 23%, almost a quarter, believe that China will become the nation's leading superpower. Now, in China, the view is, not surprisingly, that China will become the world's leading superpower in 20 years. More than half of Chinese respondents predict that, while only a fifth believe that the United States will manage to hold on to that role. We also wanted to get a sense of how these changes affected people's outlooks on this wonderful relationship between the two nations. And we found that while Americans, by and large, believe that America was accepting of China's emergence, that a majority of Chinese believe that the United States is actively trying to prevent China from becoming a superpower. So there is a fear on the Chinese side that the United States does not appreciate this emerging superpower and its economic influence. We then took a look at the issue of Taiwan, and this is very interesting because for the Chinese, when asked about the areas of concern in the relationship with the U.S., Taiwan ranks first. It is consistently, for all of the groups, the leading cause of concern. Yet for the American general public, Taiwan barely even registers. For most people in the United States, only 15% view Taiwan as a source of potential conflict. Yet here, too, we see a marked contrast. For on Capitol Hill, among senior congressional staffers, fully half of them believe that Taiwan is a likely source of conflict. So clearly the view in Washington is quite different. And when asked if they believed that the United States should intervene in the event of a Taiwan crisis, for the general public, the answer is a resounding no. 60% answer no. Only 32% answer yes, while on Capitol Hill, 49% of the staffers, just a shade under a majority, believe that the United States should intervene in the event of military conflict and hostilities between China and Taiwan. So here it is apparent that, as with many other issues, elite opinion, political leaders, that they do not share the same views as most of us here in San Francisco or elsewhere. Now, when we asked the general public in China what they thought would happen, most of them believe that there would be eventual unification through cross-strait exchange. Only a small number believe that Taiwan would be forced to return to China by the exertion of economic power or by military force. So that particular issue is one where we see a contrast, not just between the two nations, but also between the leadership here in the United States and the general populace. We then took a look at the subject of product safety, because that was on people's minds and remains a subject of concern. And we found that more than two-thirds of Americans had reduced confidence in Chinese-made goods as a result of the product safety scandal. So it clearly is on people's minds. We also found that a plurality of the Chinese public, 44%, also shared that view. That is, in China, the Chinese themselves have become less confident about Chinese-made goods because of these product safety concerns. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we saw just in 2 years a 7% decline in the favorable view that Americans had of China, and this may well have been caused by the product safety factor. We then want to drill down, as they say, and take a closer look at doing business across the ocean, across the Pacific, and we found that American business leaders perceive of China as a key destination for outsourcing of manufacturing over the next 20 years, but Chinese business leaders do not share that opinion. So while they value this bilateral exchange and trade, they don't see themselves as merely the destination for the outsourcing of U.S. jobs. When asked what the issues are that affect trade, American business leaders cite in order the following: corruption, poor intellectual property rights protection, and bureaucratic interference. While on the Chinese side, corruption and bureaucratic interference are at the top of the list. An inadequate legal system is as well. Intellectual property rights don't make the list at all. So Chinese business leaders are relatively unconcerned about intellectual property rights and their effect on doing business. You can read into that what you will. We then took a look at environmental challenges. As anyone who has been to Beijing or Shanghai recently can attest, all of this booming construction and manufacturing and what took the United States decades to do as modern manufacturing was invented is being done in years or even weeks in China. And that has, of course, its consequences in the smog and pollution that is so bad that you can barely walk down the street on some days without having to pause to catch your breath. And indeed, when we looked at what the populations themselves expressed, the Chinese were far more likely to express either a great deal or a fair amount of concern with the greenhouse gas problem and with environmental challenges. 92% of opinion leaders and 89% of business leaders in China expressed a great deal or a fair amount of concern. So they are acute acutely aware of this problem. However, in the United States, only 40% of elites and the general public express little or no concern, so only 60% express some or high level of concern. So that's another marked contrast. When we looked at how the populations of each nation assess their governments and the other government in addressing these problems, we found that Americans rated both governments as handling environmental problems poorly, but rated the Chinese government lower, while in contrast, in China, majorities rated both governments well, with the Chinese perceiving of the American government as doing a better job on environmental issues. So again here, we see a number of dichotomies that show that within the overall rosy picture and positive outlook that each nation has on the other nation and its culture, its government, and its peoples, there are these intriguing contrasts, and this comparison has certainly proven to be a worthwhile endeavor. We then wanted to take a look at the trends over a period of time. The Committee of 100 has long been interested in these issues and has conducted a number of surveys over the years, not just in 2005, where we looked at American attitudes toward China, but in 2001 as well, in which we looked at American attitudes toward Chinese Americans and Asian Americans. We've wanted to assess exactly what the sentiments are, because whatever our views, whatever our ancestry, it is important that we have the facts at hand when we engage in these important discussions. And so in taking a look at the trends, we found that a majority of Americans thought that the U.S.-China relationship is either improving or remaining stable, but that the proportion of Americans who have that view has dropped again since 2005. While among the general public and business leaders, fully one out of four of the respondents believe that the relationship has worsened. And in both groups, that's twice as high a proportion who have that negative view as was true in 2005. On the Chinese side, most believe that the bilateral relationship has changed little over time, although terms of the perception of who's at fault, on the U.S. side, opinion is divided, while on the Chinese side, most Chinese blame the U.S. government, not their own government. When we asked about how each government had handled its relations toward the other nation, 70% of Americans gave the Chinese government a negative performance rating, while a majority of Chinese hold the opposite opinion and are satisfied with their government's own performance in this U.S.-China relationship. However, when we look at the data and parse it more finely, we also find that clear majorities on both sides, both in the U.S. and in China, rate the U.S. government negatively. So Americans, as well as Chinese, are likely to take a more dim view of how the U.S. government has handled this relationship. This is all set, of course, within the context of how people feel about their own country. And so we wanted to ask a number of questions to get an assessment, a baseline for what the mood was in each country. For most Americans, when asked what the number one issue was, the most pressing national problems, they listed in order the war in Iraq, followed by the economy or jobs, followed by health care and immigration. That's the top four. While in China, the issues of concern are corruption and Taiwan just below jobs and the economy in that order. And the environment ranks high among business leaders and opinion leaders. Now, interestingly, when we take a look at contemporary U.S. attitudes and contemporary Chinese attitudes, we find a striking dichotomy. Here in the United States, there is widespread dissatisfaction among Americans about America. What we found is 3 out of 5 members of the general public, 2 out of 3 congressional staffers, and a majority of opinion and business leaders, when asked whether the United States was on the right track or the wrong track, said, "We're on the wrong track." So the United States has a pessimistic mood overall toward itself. Yet in China, The Chinese are overwhelmingly satisfied and believe that their national conditions show that they are on the right track. 88% of the general public, it's an astonishingly high proportion. Communist Party members are slightly more likely to believe that China's on the right track, 94%, but that's only a 6% difference. So 88% of Chinese, regardless of their membership in the Communist Party, believe it's on the right track. We also see different attitudes in individual outlooks on life, in aspirations and ideals. Only 8% of Americans express a desire for increased wealth. In contrast, Americans are much more interested in living as they like. So freedom for most of us Americans ranks much higher than increased wealth. However, among the Chinese, 42% aspire to increased wealth. That's a more than five-fold difference in how highly they rate that. In both countries, a solid majority believe that a happy family life is the primary goal. But just behind that, so that this is placed in perspective, what the Chinese want to do is make more money, while what the Americans want to do is lead the life that they wish to lead. We then took a look at some other very specific issues because we thought it would be of interest to both populations, to the government, and to all of us. We found that on the subject of immigration, a highly controversial issue today, that a majority of Americans believe that Chinese immigrants have a positive impact on American society in the long run. And this is, I believe, quite striking. As the child of two parents who migrated halfway around the world as students, seeking to pursue the American dream, the freedoms and opportunities that they thought were available only here, it's quite striking that one out of six, about 16% of Chinese, believe that or foresee themselves someday living in the United States. But what is more striking, I would suggest, is that that same proportion, about one in six or 16% of Americans, can see themselves someday living in China. So of all the ways to recognize the emergence of China as a power, perhaps that's one of the greatest. Americans also, by and large, have a positive view of Chinese culture, as the Chinese do of American culture. And Americans have a favorable opinion of adoptions of Chinese children and of interracial marriages. Indeed, Americans have higher opinions of both of those phenomena than the Chinese do. In terms of the improvement of this relationship, Americans and Chinese who have visited the other country tend a wide margin to hold a favorable opinion of that country that they visited. Only a quarter, fewer than a quarter of respondents report that they have traveled to the other country. So opening up the opportunity for travel, for the direct firsthand personal experience of each nation, may be a means of improving people's attitudes. We found that people lack trust in each other's news media, that the Chinese believe they are unfairly portrayed here, and Americans believe that they are unfairly portrayed in China. Congressional staffers, despite their less enthusiastic view about China, believe that they have access to all of the relevant information needed to form an opinion about China. So to summarize, what we find in this mirror survey, a survey conducted in parallel in the United States and in China, is hope and fear. At once a sense of optimism and enthusiasm on the part of Americans for China and Chinese for America, coupled with this lingering anxiety, a foreboding in the background, primarily driven by economics and the trade relationship, and to a lesser extent by the possibility of military conflict, which a number of Americans believe is a distinct possibility as China emerges not just as a superpower, but increasingly as a military power. It's the hope of the Committee of 100, a group of prominent Chinese Americans who have the dual goals of improving this relationship that is so important in this Pacific century of ours, and of ensuring the participation of Chinese Americans and Asian Americans in all aspects of our public life, that this survey will form a foundation, a factual foundation for our understanding as we look across an ocean as we try to build bridges, we now have a sense of what work remains to be done. I personally would like to emphasize the hope over the fear. I'm quite optimistic that in this global economy, we will see that this relationship is crucial, is vital to the prosperity and well-being and continued progress, not just of both nations, but of the world as a whole. So I thank you for this opportunity, and I look forward to our dialogue as we explore the meaning of hope and fear.
Our thanks to Frank Wu, Dean of the Wayne State University Law School and Vice Chair of the Committee of 100, for his comments today. We now have time for some questions, and there were a lot that came during his presentation, so I'll get right into it. Dean Wu, there's a series of questions really around how the survey was conducted. The first one is, what made up the opinion leaders in the U.S., and who were the opinion leaders in China?
These are very important questions. It's crucial for a survey of this nature, as ambitious as it is in scope and content, that we carefully document exactly how it was done so that for scholars, for those of you who will make key decisions, and everyone in this room, by virtue of being here, is someone who's not only interested in this subject, but is likely someone who will have some say, some influence. So I invite you to take a look at the full report and also on the web, where we review in copious detail all of the methodology. I'll just summarize a little bit of it. The survey was conducted here in the United States between August 20th and September 4th of 2007, and it was a standard telephonic survey. It was conducted in China between August 18th and September 7th, 2007. We wanted to, as closely as possible, conduct a parallel survey. So even the translations were very carefully checked by people who were fully bilingual in both languages so that the questions, as closely as possible, right down to the nuances, right down to the conversational style that was used, would match. And on the Chinese side, this was done with face-to-face meetings. People actually went house to house to house. Let me answer the specific question about the leaders. So on the U.S. side, the survey looked at four different groups. First, of course, the general public. Second, opinion leaders. Now, opinion leaders are a group that the Zogby firm polls quite often for many of their projects, and they have a standard way of defining opinion leaders. What they do is they interview 200 individuals who are drawn from the following samples. A quarter of them are from the media. A quarter of them are from academia. A quarter of them are from non-governmental organizations, and a quarter of them are from the public sector. And these individuals were all screened in advance so that they claimed that they were familiar with the U.S.-China ties. And so these are individuals who perceive of themselves as knowledgeable. Third group that was surveyed by Zogby here in the States were business leaders, and this was a telephonic sample of 150 business elites who are executives and senior-level decision-makers from a cross-section of American corporations with at least 500 employees or more. It's randomly drawn from trade associations, trade groups, lobby firms, chambers of commerce, and economic development groups. Congressional staffers, this was a sample of 100 congressional staffers, randomly selected senior staff. So these are individuals with titles such as legislative counsel, legislative director, legislative assistant, chief of staff, and senior advisor. And they were weighted to represent the partisan mix in the current Congress. On the Chinese side, the 4,004 respondents, all adults between 18 and 60, were selected using a multi-stage random sampling method, and they came from seven major cities, seven towns, and 10 villages. The opinion leaders in China were drawn from a select group. They consisted of 60 social science experts from universities and research institutions, 62 senior journalists and editors, 44 senior managers from non-governmental organizations, and 37 senior professionals in law, accounting, marketing, and consulting. The business leaders in China were drawn from 156 business elites in Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou. The sample was constructed using a group drawn from multiple sectors. Those would include manufacturing, agricultural, and service, and they included companies that were state-owned, joint venture, and purely private. So you can take a look, and we break down because we think it's important to be as detailed as possible about this, because we would like those of you who also engage in your own survey research or who have scholarly research pursuits to take a look at this and to assess it, and we would invite your feedback as we look at following up this survey with further surveys of this nature.
Based on what you said, would it be fair to say that most of the survey respondents were predominantly urbanites, even though you did choose from some of the non-urban areas?
No, we've worked very hard to ensure that is not an issue for us. The Zogby firm was very careful to sample so that we represented different regions, political parties, ages, races, genders, religions, and so on and so forth. So we believe we've accounted for that. Now, it is possible that you will see some variation between the attitudes in a major city, someplace such as New York or San Francisco on the one hand, and Peoria or elsewhere in the U.S., or equally on the Chinese side. I wouldn't doubt that for a moment, but the overall results that we've presented, we have done everything we can to ensure that these differences either don't matter or that we've analyzed them. Let me highlight one, if I may, for you. We find that there is a slight racial difference here on the U.S. side. We find that Hispanic and African Americans hold slightly more favorable views of China than do Caucasian Americans. And we also do see some differences if you take a look at income. You can correlate it just a little bit. This may surprise some people. It certainly surprised me. Within the general public, individuals with a higher income, are more likely by a small margin to hold a negative opinion of China than individuals in a lower income bracket. On the Chinese side, interestingly, we find that Chinese Communist Party members are more likely than non-Communist Party members to hold a favorable opinion of the U.S. So we've tried to account for these differences, and if you take a look at that particular issue, you find that 74% of Communist Party members hold the U.S. in high regard, but only 60% of non-Communist Party members. So this survey is also full of its little puzzles for us to unpack.
Knowing that China is a more closed society, how are such public surveys viewed, and how can you therefore rely on the candor of the survey respondents?
That's an excellent question, and that's why we chose the survey firm that we did. It is a survey firm based in China, but that is headed by someone trained in Western survey methods, trained at Yale, someone whose work is relied upon. Really, this is the leading firm in China, whether it is for purposes such as this or for market research. And on the Chinese side, within the general public, our margin of error was only plus or minus 1.6%. That compares with a margin of error of 2.9% on the U.S. side. So at least in statistical terms, the Chinese survey was conducted with a lower margin of error than on the U.S. side. It is more reliable. Now, in part to address some of the issues, they conducted, as I had mentioned, a face-to-face survey. They actually visited these households in order to ensure they were able to reach them and able to receive answers that were more candid.
Who financed the survey?
This survey was sponsored by the Committee of 100. The Committee of 100 is a nonpartisan group, and we present this survey without a specific policy view. We invite others to draw their conclusions. We've done as much as we can, really bent over backwards to ensure that we're as neutral as possible. Indeed, I don't even know my colleague Dr. Cheng Li's views on most issues concerning China or Chinese politics, and I doubt that he knows mine. So this is something that we've done in an effort to provide the facts. C100 has been around for some time. It was founded by prominent Chinese Americans, as you may know. I know many of you in the room are members or know people who are members. It was founded by people such as the cellist Yo-Yo Ma. It was founded by I.M. Pei and others of similar stature.
You just mentioned Yo-Yo Ma, so this is a related question. Did the survey ask about culture, such as music, theater, and the arts, and respective opinions around culture?
We did look just a little bit and found that there were generally positive views. We didn't ask about specific performers or specific types of art. We also asked about the upcoming 2008 Olympics and the Summer Games. And what we found is that everyone is certainly aware of the Summer Games coming up. Both Americans and Chinese have very positive attitudes about Beijing playing host to the Games, and they expect that the Games will help improve China's global image. Now, it's interesting, though, they have some different views on what China should focus on in projecting, what sort of image would be best. Americans and both Americans and Chinese believe that it's important to talk about a prosperous, modern nation with a proud culture and history. But the Chinese place an equal importance on the image of a harmonious society, something which is not as important to those surveyed here in the United States. I might add that it doesn't seem especially important for Americans to project an image that America itself is harmonious, so it's no great surprise.
How do the Chinese view America's idea of democracy and vice versa? How do Americans view China's idea of democracy?
Well, we asked about the transition to democracy, and a majority of Americans believe that China will eventually fully transition into a democracy. And in both countries, there's an optimistic view about the rapid growth of China's middle class and a belief that the middle class will become the largest and most influential class. And, of course, on the American side, there's a belief that this will be the world's largest consumer society, something that business leaders especially look forward to. We did not ask, this is the only deviation from the parallel surveys, we did not ask the Chinese directly about the subject of whether China would become a fully democratic nation. And in part, that's because we did want to ensure greater candor. And as we designed the survey, we thought that that particular question might not be one to which we would get the best results, and it might skew some of the other data. So we refrained from asking that particular question.
Okay. We have a series of questions more around economics, so I'll start with one of them. You noted that American businesses view China as an opportunity for outsourcing. How do Americans view this potential loss of jobs to China, and do the Chinese perceive the same, that they would be beneficiaries of many current American jobs?
Right. This is very interesting. We asked actually a number of questions about business and trade and jobs. And as we look in greater detail, it becomes even more complex. So we asked about specifically the issue of losing jobs. And three out of four Americans, 75%, this is one of the larger margins that you'll find for any of the questions in the survey, believe that China is responsible for the loss of U.S. jobs. So there's no question that although overall Americans believe that trade with China is beneficial, that they also attribute causation here, that the trade with China is creating a problem in the loss of U.S. jobs, and they're anxious about that. We did ask the following question. We asked about outsourcing in particular, and whether people agreed that the United States should not outsource jobs even if it meant higher prices for U.S. consumers. And a majority agreed with that. So a majority of Americans oppose outsourcing even if it leads to higher prices. And so this is an area that is fraught with peril, and hence the hope and fear theme. It's an area where we find that even as Americans generally favor trade, they are concerned about the loss of jobs and about the trade deficit. So it is certainly something that should be on the minds of all of us as we look at increased trade.
What do Americans believe the future holds for affordability of Chinese products, as improvement in safety standards are required and potentially the cost of production increases?
Right. That's a good question. Let me actually just add on the trade issue something else that I should note. This is very interesting. Americans are more likely to blame the American government, the U.S. government, for the trade deficit with China rather than the Chinese government. So while Chinese tend to hold a favorable view of their own government on many of the questions, we find that Americans hold a less than positive view of their own government. So it isn't just that they view, in some instances, the Chinese government with some hostility or some suspicion. Americans hold their own government in that same regard. In terms of product safety, what we took a look at is confidence in products primarily, and we found that there was reduced confidence in Chinese-made products. Some people even joked about Chinese toys like gasoline coming in leaded and unleaded versions. We did not look at the issue of increased quality of Chinese goods. That is certainly an area that should be looked at in a follow-up study at whether the perception of Chinese products will rebound from the product safety issues that have been so dominant in the news.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Frank Wu, Dean of Wayne State University Law School and Vice Chair of the Commonwealth Club, Vice Chair of the Committee of 100, a Chinese-American organization that has commissioned a new survey on Chinese and American attitudes towards one another. We're discussing the results of that survey. Dean Wu, Saudi Arabia also has human rights issues, and many other countries have defective problems. Based on the survey, did it conclude that China was being picked on, perhaps because of its size and strength in the global context?
That's one possible interpretation. We did not look with a great detail at the views that Americans had of other nations, although we did take a look a little bit at some of that and found that Americans had a long list of other nations that were viewed as the most important partners. The issue of exactly how to interpret and read these results, what accounts for some of the less than positive attitudes, is something that we leave for all of our readers as we present this data and for the follow-up work that C100 will be doing. There certainly are many opportunities to ensure that the publics both here and in China are better informed about the other nation.
Based on some of the interpretation of the survey results, would you recommend that all businesses need a China business strategy? And if so, what would you think would be key components of that strategy?
Well, it's clear that doing business across the Pacific is, if not the leading issue, then certainly on the top, near the top of the list for all business leaders. Because of the prediction that business leaders have that China will be the largest consumer economy, among the factors that they should bear in mind is exactly what sort of business will be done in China. Because of this divergence between the American view and the Chinese view of the importance of outsourcing, there are many other ways to partner with China beyond just outsourcing. It's clear that addressing and helping China reform in terms of corruption and in terms of its legal system, that's on the minds of both American and Chinese business leaders. So addressing issues of the rule of law, and for American businesses in particular, addressing the issue of patent and copyrights, ensuring that the system that we have to respect those rights is also applied and enforced in China, that is certainly something that is at the top of the list, especially for those, this is no surprise, in high tech. There is a solid majority of American business leaders who believe that the poor intellectual property rights system in China is negative and is affecting adversely the possibility of trade and business. Now, how that will be done is up to all of us here, those of us who may be able to in some way cajole Chinese businesses or the Chinese government into changing the system that it has.
You just mentioned the rule of law. How much do you believe that the lack of the rule of law in China contributes to the viewpoints of both U.S. and Chinese in this study?
There's no question that it does. I say that because you find that Chinese business leaders also rank corruption, bureaucratic interference, and an inadequate legal system as their top three problems for doing business in their own nation. So this is not just an American view of China. This is a Chinese view of China. Chinese business leaders are greatly concerned about all of these factors. So there's absolutely no question that there's a tremendous amount of work to be done.
We had a series of questions about the military, so we're lucky to have General Fu in the audience. Why do so many Americans see China as a military threat?
Well, I'm not sure why they see it as a military threat, but I can tell you that there's no question that many do see it as a military threat. There's increasing anxiety. 3 out of 4 Americans, 75%, see China's emergence as a military power as posing a serious or potential threat, and this is an increase since 2005. It's up about 9% just in 2 years, although, to be as precise as possible, most sense that China is a potential threat rather than a serious one. We offered them a number of options, and most who see it as a threat pick it as just a potential threat, not a serious one. It may in part be because of the changing attitudes over time in how China is perceived overall. The military threat, it's clear, it's part of this sense that China is emerging as a superpower, something that is new in the lifetimes of those of us in this room, this notion that China will once again ascend to superpower status that it may have held in days gone by, well before any of us. This is novel and it's new. It may also be coupled, at least for those congressional staffers and others who are aware of it, to the Taiwan issue, although I wouldn't overrate that, because for most Americans in the general public, Taiwan does not register. Only 15% view Taiwan as an issue, a source of potential conflict between the U.S. and China.
Did the survey touch on Chinese people's view of war, such as the Iraqi war, or other wars outside of China, and their concerns around war in general?
It did, in the sense that when asked about their perceptions of the United States, the war, the ongoing war in Iraq, the war on terrorism, ranked as number one in terms of the perception of the U.S. in the minds of the Chinese. So when they look at the U.S., it today is largely through the lens of that ongoing war. So there's no question that it is a crucial factor. It is the single leading factor in shaping the perception of the U.S.
We also had a series of questions regarding human rights and the environment. So I'll start with the human rights one, which is, how do each population views each country's position on human rights and also their views of what should be done or what their respective responsibilities are around human rights.
Well, here you see quite a contrast. When you look at the concerns in U.S.-China relations, human rights ranks just behind loss of jobs and trade deficit on the U.S. side. So on the minds of the American public, the general public, China's human rights situation looms large. But the Chinese do not list human rights as a concern, either human rights in China or human rights in the United States. So here's another example of a disconnect of sorts, that what is paramount for one nation, for its peoples, barely registers for the other.
On the topic of the environment, one of our members of the audience asked, why should Americans carefully recycle when in China you can see pollution everywhere and you can see it in the air? So what are really, from the survey, were there any insights into what each respective populace felt about global warming and about the environment and their respective responsibilities?
Well, it's interesting. I confess that I personally was surprised to find that despite the discussion about the environment, about global warming, despite Al Gore's movie and so on, that for the American public, fully 40% of them express little or no concern about the problem. So while a majority, 60%, are concerned about the environment and global warming, the U.S. is less concerned on the whole than the Chinese are. Overwhelmingly, the Chinese express concern about environmental challenges. So perhaps the level of pollution that is so visible in China causes the public there to be more aware. We asked to provide some greater detail on this about stewardship and responsibility. And we found that when asked to assess the performance of each government, the following, that when asked to assess the performance of the Chinese government, for Americans, 80% viewed the Chinese government's performance as fair or poor, and only 10% regarded it as better than fair. So the conventional view in the U.S. is that China, the Chinese government, is doing a very poor job in terms of these issues. And the Chinese hold a rather favorable view of the Chinese government. A full 79% of them believe that the Chinese government is doing a good or fair job, and 6% believe it's doing an excellent job. Now, when asked about the U.S. government's performance, this also is very interesting. When you look at the American perception, we find that 7% believe that the American government's doing an excellent job, 22% believe it's a good job, but a plurality, 44%, give the American government only a fair rating, and a full 26% of Americans give the American government a poor rating. The Chinese population, again, is more inclined to be positive toward the American government than Americans are. 46% of Chinese respondents would say that the American government's doing a good job. Again, to give you some sense of this, more than twice the proportion of Chinese believe the American government's doing a good job than Americans hold that view. So we see that fairly consistent pattern of greater faith in government performance on the Chinese side than in the U.S. side. So there is awareness on both sides. There is a sense of responsibility, but also a concern on both sides about the performance of both of the states, of their governments.
From the survey, was there evidence that survey respondents expected to see more collaboration between China and U.S. on topics such as global warming, international peacekeeping, and healthcare?
Yes, there is. There's a recognition when asked about the relationships that are important that on both sides there's a sense that this relationship is increasingly the most important bilateral relationship among all. So on the Chinese side, there's just absolutely no question about it. The relationship with the U.S. ranks as the number one relationship in terms of how the Chinese public views the matter. For Americans, though, England and Japan still outrank China. When asked to select from a list, more Americans believe that the relationship with England is of vital importance, and then Japan, followed by China. But the perception over time is also one of change, because if you take a look at what nations will become the leading superpower, here we asked about more than just China. We asked about the European Union, Russia, India, or other. And when asked about which nation or political region will become the world's leading superpower 20 years from now, although American respondents are confident, 49% at least, that America will be the leading superpower, 23% pick China, which is the number two option. Only 10% pick the European Union, 5% Russia, 2% India, and 4% other, with 7% answering that they weren't sure. So in other words, Americans believe that either the U.S. will remain the leading superpower, or to the extent that they have a concern, they would bet on China. Only very small numbers believe that the European Union or Russia will emerge as the leading superpower.
You're listening to the Commonwealth of California radio program. And our guest is Frank Wu, Dean of Wayne State University Law School and Vice Chair of the Committee of 100, a Chinese-American organization that has commissioned a new survey on Chinese and American attitudes towards one another. We're discussing the results of that survey. Professor Wu, in the last 300 years, one name stands out as the single name of highest contribution to universal prosperity, and that's Deng Xiaoping. He's believed to be a techno-utopian capitalism, and he believes that that can coexist within socialism. Did the survey, based on the results of the survey, do you agree with that characterization?
Well, I think it's important, consistent with what C100 has always done and with the survey, not to make a comment about a specific leader along those lines. So I'll leave that for all of the readers to judge for themselves based on what our survey shows.
Okay. With the Olympic Games coming this summer, what do you think that will do for Chinese and American relations, and that the survey asks people's opinions about the Olympics being in China?
Well, there's no question that everyone's eyes will be on the Games, on Beijing, in just a few months. And certainly in China, there has been an unprecedented level of construction and activity to ready that global city for the arrival of the Games. They are viewed both by the Chinese and here in the United States as an opportunity for China to shine. Perhaps that will be an opportunity as well to overcome the slight decline here that we've seen in the perception due to the product safety scandals. Those really have been one of the major ways that China has appeared in the press and in the public mind and popular culture over the past year. And as that recedes from memory, and as the competition for the medals and the friendly competition among nations assumes center stage, there's a real chance there for China to bounce back.
Earlier in your comments, Professor Wu, you mentioned some of the bridge-building efforts that are required. Our audience is interested in hearing who do you think should be driving some of those bridge-building efforts, and what can individuals do or organizations do to strengthen the U.S.-China relations?
I would list three top factors here. The first is that travel and visits, personal contact with and knowledge of the other culture, there's no question that that helps. There's no question that travel and that direct contact is, in my view, superior to any other means of learning about a different culture. Second, I'd mention the news media. There's widespread distrust of the news media in both countries, and so obtaining additional sources of data learning more and correcting perhaps some of the bias that's common in the mainstream press. And third and finally, it's apparent that congressional staffers have markedly different views of China than the general public, not just on the Taiwan issue, although it's most apparent there, but the sentiment inside the Beltway, inside Washington, D.C., among the top advisors to members of Congress does not mirror what most Americans believe. There are many ways to look at that. It may be due to lobbying efforts inside the Beltway. There are many possible causes, although congressional staffers themselves believe that they're quite well informed. So regardless of who's right here, the folks on Capitol Hill or all of us, it's apparent that efforts to influence congressional staffers, the redoubling of efforts in Washington, D.C., as C-100 has started to do, that's crucial.
Based on the survey, what were some of the greatest misperceptions of Chinese of Americans and also of Americans of Chinese? In other words, what were some of the stereotypes perhaps that emerged based on the survey?
Well, we find that the economy and what is positive also generates the apprehension and the anxiety. So rather than suggest that it's a single stereotype, I would say that this shows that human beings are capable of thinking many contradictory thoughts all at once. That even at the moment that we look to China as a trading partner, as a place to do business, to sell goods, to manufacture goods, we as a nation also, it is clear, worry about the rise of China, what that means for our nation, for the United States in terms of loss of jobs, the trade deficit. It isn't so much a stereotype as a pattern that emerges here, a pattern of both hope and fear. The Committee of 100 survey is offered to all of you as a lens through which we can see this relationship and by which we can judge it for years to come.
Unfortunately, we've reached a time in our program where we have time just for one last question. We'll put it on a personal basis for you, Professor Wu. So as a Chinese American, what gratifies you the most about the survey results and what concerns you the most?
What's most gratifying to me as a Chinese American is that people on both sides hold generally positive views. And I'll just conclude by saying this survey made me realize my mother was right. I should have paid attention in Chinese school, that there is so much to be learned, and that China, dynamic as it is increasingly important in the future of all of us. Thank you so much.
Our thanks to Frank Wu, Dean of Wayne State University Law School and Vice Chair of the Committee of 100. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Anna Mok, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.